Well, chicken strips, tater tots, and Wonder Bread. If we are what we eat, then what have school lunches allowed us to become? We simply must do better, right? But wait, can schools serve good food in hard times?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 647th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Port Stanley who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford is on the phones today. Folks, the renegade lunch lady recently came to our town, like she has with other towns across the land, to change the way schools feed children. You could hear her banging pots and pans clear across town as she proclaimed, out with the old and in with the fresh and local. But wait, our town, like most towns in the lately great state of California, is flat broke. And this state of affairs leads us to ask, can schools serve good food in hard times? Here to help us cook up an answer, we have the lunch lady herself, the renegade lunch lady herself, Ann Cooper. Ann, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you aboard. So, you're the author of four books. Yep. What's your latest?
Yeah, four books, and the latest is Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children.
Good. And you were a chef, a chef of a very Tony restaurant as well, correct?
I was a chef for many years. I worked in my own restaurant, others' restaurants, hotels, cruise ships, all over this country, overseas, and spent a lot of time doing world cruises. So I've been a lot of places before I landed as a lunch lady.
Good. But the question I really wanted to ask you, Ann, the reason you dropped out of high school, was it because of the school lunches?
It was not. I think it was the times. Let's just say it had a lot to do with the late 60s.
Okay. Well, good. Renegade, how did you go from being a chef to becoming the renegade lunch lady?
You know, I'm such an unlikely candidate to be a school lunch advocate. I really was in white tablecloth restaurants, a little bit of a celebrity chef, really making, you know, beautiful chef food. And I never fed kids, you know, it was white tablecloth dining, no kids came in. And the worst thing you could say to me on a Saturday night or a host coming in going, chef, chef, there's a crying kid on table 19, what are you going to do? And I'd say, ask him to leave, what's he doing in my restaurant on a Saturday night? I mean, I really had no idea what kids were eating. And when I wrote my second book, Bitter Harvest, which came out in the late 90s, I was really starting to think about why food made us sick and how food was making kids sick. And around that time in 1999, Courtney Ross, whose now deceased husband was Stephen Ross, who made Time Warner, decided as his legacy she was going to reinvent education, and a core value was going to be wellness. And she hired me to start a program at the Ross School in East Hampton, New York, Regional Organic Seasonal Sustainable. And originally, I didn't really want to do it. I just couldn't see myself as a lunch lady. But then all of a sudden, I realized, you know, maybe I could make a difference. Maybe I really could make things better for kids all across our country.
Well, you know, Anna, I was not much of reminiscing about school lunches, because what I remember from them wasn't much to remember. What I really remember is Wonder Bread and how you could take a piece of Wonder Bread and compress it down into a missile that you could throw across, clear across. That's all I remember about the school lunch programs, really. And then I was visiting Chico, California, and you know, frequent listeners to the program are going to know the story. But at any rate, I picked up a local newspaper, and there's a letter to the editor, a person that was visiting school lunch to pay the bill, and asked the lunch lady, where does the food come from? The lunch lady said, well, all the canned food is now coming from China. And she showed the guy the canned, and there it said, produce of China. And that, to me, is just got me thinking, if we are what we eat, what are our school children going to become eating that stuff?
They'll probably become some processed form of a chicken nugget eventually. I mean, if we keep down this road, that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm now the interim director of nutrition services for Boulder Valley School District. But before I took this position, we were here doing a feasibility study, and one of the first things we found was can upon can upon can of mandarin oranges from China. And it's like...
So it wasn't just Chico then?
Oh, no. This is all across the country. I mean, most school districts have a lot of commodity food, and much of this commodity food doesn't necessarily... The commodity food is all canned or frozen, by and large, and that doesn't all come from other countries. But when they run out of the government commodity food and we start buying, you know, like canned and frozen items, much of it comes from other countries, and that's just crazy. That's just crazy.
So what is going to happen to our children if we keep feeding them the way we have been feeding them?
Well, the Center for Disease Control has said of the children born in the year 2000, those 9-year-olds in our starting school in the next couple weeks, one out of every 3 Caucasians and one out of every 2 African-Americans and Hispanics are going to have diabetes in their lifetime, many before they graduate.
One out of 3 and one out of 2.
One out of 3 Caucasians, one out of 2 African-Americans and Hispanics. These are staggering statistics. And many will have contract diabetes before they graduate high school, the result of which is going to be these same children will be the first generation in our country's history to die at a younger age than their parents. Most, almost all of that being preventable because it's diet-related. I mean, if we as a nation can't hear that fact and think there's something really wrong and we have to fix it, I don't know what it is that will take us, will make us as a nation really look at this issue and understand it's probably the crisis of our lifetime.
Well, let me ask you this, and this to me is one of the more interesting elements to this equation. What happened to parents? You know, I can remember being a child and going to school, and the school lunches were always minimal, if anything, and yet we could survive because parents took care to feed us when we came home, and when we woke up, there was breakfast, and when we came home, there was snack, and there was a big dinner, and then usually a sack lunch to take to school. What happened to parents in this equation?
Well, there are a lot of parents who are in financial circumstances such that they can feed their kids and choose to feed their kids in a very healthy manner, that their kids go to school with breakfast in the morning, that they have a nice packed lunch, that they come home to snack and dinner. But the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, which oversees the National School Lunch Program, through that program, we're feeding 5.4 billion lunches a day, 30 million
what?
Children
How many?
A day. 5.4 billion lunches a year. It's about 30 million a day, 5.4 billion lunches a year. Many, many, many of those lunches are going to underprivileged children. So I don't think that parents are, by and large, choosing not to, you know, feed their kids, but I think especially as you said, in these hard times, in these financial times, many children get most of their, or much if not most of their nutrition at school. So it's super important that, you know, I feel like school lunch and the bad food we're feeding kids is a social justice issue for our time, and that we have a moral...
What do you mean by that, Anne?
Well, so right now, the statistics say that the achievement gap and the life expectancy gap between rich and poor is widening and widening. And most school administrators will tell you that they're really, you know, one of their big challenges is overcoming the achievement gap. So kids from poor, at-risk families will do far less and achieve far less in school than kids from rich families. That's, you know, that's being tracked. And also, you know, when we look at this generation being the first in our country's history to die at a younger age than their parents, that also runs along demographic lines. So because the National School Lunch Program feeds, you know, pays for these 5.4 billion lunches a year, and many, many, many of those kids are coming from these at-risk homes, then if we really want to have a nation of equals, if we really believe we're a nation in which every child can excel and exceed to the best of their abilities, then one of the ways we're going to help them is make sure that they're nourished, that they're not malnourished. You know, hungry kids can't think and they can't learn.
Are you familiar with the work of Dr. Stephen Schoenthaler?
I am not.
Cal State University criminology professor who did a study on crime and nourishment, if you will. And he looked at the nutrient content of food and its relationship to criminal behavior. And he did... double-blind studies in prisons and in schools, where he fed one half the population a sugar pill and one half the population a cheap multivitamin. And those who had the multivitamin, their criminal behavior went down by 40%. And those with a sugar pill showed no change. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with chef, author, and renegade lunch lady Ann Cooper. The question of the day, can schools serve good food in hard times? And lots of reasons for us to do that. When we get back, we'll explore more of them with Ann Cooper. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, the federal government now feeds 30 million children a day to the tune of about $8.5 billion a year. That is big business, feeding school children. And yet all of those lunches seem to be pretty drab, right? What do you get for a school lunch? Chicken strips, tater tots, and Wonder Bread. My goodness, can't we do better? So a quick question before we move on. Are parents no longer responsible for feeding their children? Anne?
I think that in a perfect world, parents are responsible. But just in the same way, I mean, we could make the case, aren't parents responsible to help their kids read or to teach their kids to read? And aren't parents responsible to teach their kids math? And I think part of our educational system in America is to support parents and teach our kids to be the best they can be. And not all parents have the resources. And because of that, I think, and the kids that need the resources the most are the ones that are most at risk. And that's what our government should be doing, is taking care of our most at-risk kids.
Okay.
And in schools, that means feeding these kids and making sure they're well-nourished.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ingredients in the typical school lunch, if you will, the political and economic ingredients. It's, I guess it costs the government, what, $2.59 to feed a child?
It's actually going up in this coming school year to just under $2.70.
$2.70. Now, you make note that most of that money does not go for food.
That's right. Two-thirds of it goes to payroll and overhead in most schools. I would say that the average school is spending somewhere between 85 cents and $1.05 on food. And if you think that, you know, as a listener, you know, all our listeners out there, if I said take $4 and go to the grocery store and buy food to have lunch for yourself and three friends, so four people for lunch, and it has to be 750 calories, delicious, nutritious, include milk and fruit. Can you do that, you know, at $1 a person? And even as a, you know, I've been a chef my whole career, it's really, really hard, if not impossible, to do that. There just needs to be more money if we want to serve kids healthy food.
Mm-hmm. So almost two-thirds of the money, though, that we're putting into each school lunch does not go for food. It goes for government, I guess, right?
Well, no, much of it goes to, payroll. It goes to the people who are serving the food, mm-hmm. you know, cleaning the cafeterias. But
okay.
it doesn't necessarily just go onto the child's plate.
Okay, good. I guess my point was that it seems like it would be cheaper to somehow have the parents feed the children because then 100% of the money would go into the child's belly, and maybe they would get more food. But maybe if the parents aren't there to do the feeding, then somebody does have to step forward, or the rest of us will pay for it one way or another. So let's talk about the political elements of the traditional school lunch. And it being an $8.5 billion a year industry, we assume that there are a lot of people lined up in the halls of Washington to get their piece of that pie. Is that true?
That's probably somewhat true. The biggest problem with this is it's a big omnibus bill. It
right.
comes up every 4 or 5 years. But part of this big bill is under the USDA, and it also includes the commodity food program. And the commodity food program is part of the farm bill. So, you know, numerous parts of the government sort of direct this. And the commodity food bill is where the commodity food is where the government pays farmers for excess mm-hmm. food. So in this case, it's often corn and soy. And it's not corn or soy that we would eat. It's not like edamame and nice summer corn. It ends up being corn that is made into high fructose corn syrup and soy that's made into trans fats. And because the government commodifies them, these crops, they're not even really food, these crops become very inexpensive ingredients that end up making up the food that becomes chicken nuggets, tater tots, chocolate milk, and canned food cocktail, which is a typical school lunch. So because the government guidelines allow chicken nuggets, tater tots, chocolate milk, and in some cases really popsicles to be school lunch, then we really see all this unhealthy food being pushed down into the system.
So part of the situation here then is that the government, for whom we pay almost two-thirds of our lunch money dollar to, is the way they keep track of things is that they count nutrients, right?
They do. They count. You can be certified to serve food to kids by a food-based system or a nutrient-based system. But one of the things, and maybe this is addressing the idea that so much goes back to the government. I mean, the money comes from the government, but there's a very, very involved way that we as lunch ladies or nutrition services directors have to account for how kids eat. I mean, we spend an inordinate amount of time counting and counting and counting just so, you know, no hungry kid's going to steal, if you will, a school lunch. I mean, I think that it would be much better if we had a system where every kid was fed, universal breakfast, universal lunch, and parents could still send their kids and not all kids would have to eat it. But if it was offered to everybody and we didn't have to keep counting, and do this inordinate amount of paperwork, and schools have these really involved software point-of-sale systems, and we buy computers and we buy all this stuff to track the system, I mean, we're better off just feeding the kids. And frankly, That's what I was trying to get at.
You know, when two-thirds of our money is going toward government, wouldn't it be better to just figure out how to put three-thirds of the money into the children's belly and good food?
Well, and I think that's, you know, one of the things a lot of advocates are saying now is if we had universal meals in school and we didn't have all the accounting, that we would have a lot more money for food.
Mm-hmm. So this is really changing, it seems to me, at least, changing the nature of schools, or is it? Did schools always feed children?
No, yeah. Not always, but we've been feeding kids, for decades and decades. The National School Lunch Program started as a national security program because for World War II, we had so many malnourished teenagers, so many malnourished young men, mm-hmm. that they weren't actually fit to fight in the Army. Of course, now we're too fat to fight, many, many Americans, but at that point, they were too malnourished, so the National School Lunch Program was started as a way to make sure that we had, you know, recruits for the armies. Additionally, it became clear that children couldn't learn if they were hungry. So those two things were the beginning. And then as it evolved, it also became a way to support agribusiness, big agriculture in America.
Where does the diabetes come in? Why are children getting so overweight, I guess?
Well, I think that those are two different issues. I think the reason why I think that why we're seeing so much diabetes is because of highly processed food, refined sugars, refined flours, high fructose corn syrup. It's become ubiquitous in our country. I mean, if you go to a grocery store and try and buy a hamburger roll or a hot dog roll or bread or pizza crust or hot dogs or hamburgers, almost all of them are going to have sugar in them. I mean, everything has
and
sugar.
Soy.
and sugar and soy. Everything's got sugar and soy because of the way we commodify our food. And because we have these ubiquitous ingredients that are like ghosts, I mean, you don't need to have them in there. They weren't always in there. But because of that, we're seeing our calorie counts go up and up and up. And those calorie counts, especially with refined sugars and refined flours in the way that we eat them, really wreaks havoc on our system and is the cause of, you know, partially the cause of the diabetes epidemic. That's different than why there are so many kids overweight, because there's another issue, and that's exercise. I mean, our kids are not getting exercised right. The way we used to. I mean, when I grew up, you know, in the summertime, you were almost never allowed in the house. You, like, woke up and you were shepherded out the door.
Out.
Right. Totally. Get out of the house. Go play. And if it was raining, maybe you could sit on the porch. But, you know, we didn't have Game Boys. We all rode our bikes to school. There was athletics in school. There was recess in school. There was gym in school. And much of that is gone. So, you know, that we have this sort of perfect storm around obesity now because we've got all these empty calories in our diet. You know, kids are drinking more soda than water. So we have all these empty calories. We've got this high fructose corn syrup. We're wrecking our systems, and we've got diabetes. But obesity is also because we're not getting exercise in the way we did. Kids do not play. They don't ride their bikes to school. You know, they don't. They're not outside. They've got Game Boys. They got computers. You know, we're now living in a country where one out of every four meals is eaten in fast food. One out of every four meals in front of a TV, computer, or Game Boy, a blue screen, and one out of every four meals in a car. I mean, we've sort of lost social.
One out of every four meals are eaten in a car?
In a car.
Whoa.
What are we teaching our children that, you know, you're in
this? If we are what we eat, what are we becoming? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with chef, author, and renegade lunch lady, Ann Cooper. She's out to change the way we feed our children. And hey, maybe it's a good idea. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, the question I have is that by adding all of these things to our food and processing them and processing and processing them, do we get more nutrients or less for our dollar? What do you think, Ann Cooper?
I think we get less. I mean, although I will say that, you know, the idea that we add, you know, nutrients to white bread, you know, we enhance the white bread, or we add...
Well, that's because you're starting with nothing, right?
Well, that's right, because if you had just left the bread, the flour alone to be whole grain bread, whole grain flour, you wouldn't have to add the stuff back. And, you know, the idea that we're adding calcium to orange juice or adding vitamin C to orange juice, or, you know, I think, you know, it's really because we've messed with our food supply. I mean, if you want kids to have vitamin C, let's let them have some real orange juice and eat oranges. You know, if we need more calcium, let's find things besides dairy. I mean, dairy is a good source of calcium, but there's lots of other things, greens and beans. And so we really have to think about food, and we've gotten so caught up in nutrients. I mean, Michael Pollan and Mary Nessel both talk about that. We've stopped thinking about food and started thinking about nutrients, and so we might be adding nutrients to things, but what we really need is food for a balanced, healthy diet.
So what is good food, then?
Good food, in my estimation, what I believe we should be feeding kids is a diet high in fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and clean protein.
Can you get that from the national commodity system?
There are ways that you can get some of it, not all of it. For instance, the commodity system, you know, spends a tremendous billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars on corn and soy, but not a whole bunch on lettuce or carrots or cucumbers or tomatoes or broccoli. And if we commodified food that we ate as opposed to commodified products that were made into ingredients, I think that we would have a much better food system.
Rich in naturally occurring nutrients. I guess that's what we're talking about, right? Instead of having whole grain bread, we have white bread, and then have to add the stuff back in. So what you suggest is that get rid of the white bread.
That's right. In all of our schools in Berkeley and now all of our schools in Boulder, the baked products are whole grains. It's really easy. You know, you have whole grain. If you're going to serve bread, you have whole grain bread. It's not hard. And it's funny, I was in a grocery store the other day, and I was standing waiting to pick up some stuff, and I was just looking at the bread section, and there's big signs on a lot of the bread, all wheat. Well, yeah, of course bread is wheat, you know, but
most breads now have soy in them.
Well, yes, but this was as opposed to being whole wheat. Now it says all wheat. You know,
okay.
I think they're just trying to, like, trick us into, you know, thinking that, you
that's
know,
like,
white.
That's like Walmart hanging up signs that say local.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah,
sure
exactly the same thing.
Also, foods processed without hormones, antibiotics, colors, or preservatives.
I think this is really important. I mean, one of my soapboxes with kids especially is that we shouldn't be feeding them antibiotics and hormones. And we had another foodborne illness outbreak, a salmonella outbreak, very recently at another meat packing plant in California where the meat was destined for school food. This is not the first time. I mean, we see salmonella, we see foodborne illnesses in our food supply, and we just have to change that. The thing with the antibiotics is, you know, we all know kids and adults as well, but especially kids who get sick, get a flu, can't get better, just stay ill. I mean, it's really horrible. And much of it, not all of it, but much of it is because, you know, 70% of all the antibiotics consumed in our country is consumed in animal protein. So, you know, we're eating and drinking our antibiotics. It's no wonder we have these, you know, we have these viruses or, you know, diseases that just don't go away.
Well, and school districts around the country are starting to seek out your services. Come help fix us, please. And what happens when you go into a school district that is set up on the commodity school lunch program? How do you, I mean, that's a revolution.
It's a tremendous amount of work. Here in Boulder, where I am now, we spent almost nine months working on a feasibility study, and then after that spent another 6 months working on some initial implementation, and now I have a year contract to start even some secondary implementation. It takes a long, long time. There's five major challenges to making these changes.
Mm-hmm.
Food, where are you going to get it, and how are you going to
so,
make sure...
So, yeah, you're in Boulder. Where are you going to get food?
Where are you going to get the food? Finances, how are you going to pay for it? Facilities, how are you going to cook it? Many of the kitchens have been dismantled, or the facilities are really old. Human resources, how are you going to teach everybody how to cook? We just ended a five-day training session where we had all 170 nutrition services employees spending 5 days training, because when you have people who have been used to just handling processed food and now you're going to have fresh food, there's a lot of training. And finally, marketing, how are you going to get the kids to eat it? So these are challenges that all school districts have to deal with, and it's things that, you know, every day we just get up every day and say, okay, how can we make it a little bit better?
Well, those are some very interesting points, and I'd like to go through them if we might. How on earth do you find food in Boulder? It can't all be fresh. It can't all be local. So what do you do?
Well, you know, you start taking baby steps. I think of regional as concentric circles that
mm-hmm.
grow, you know, that
sure.
grow and contract. And right now, there's actually plenty of local food. In fact, when we're done with the interview, I'm going to go to the farmer's market. And there's beautiful, lots of local food. But, you know, 90 days from now, we're going to be in winter greens and root vegetables. So then we say, okay, how do we make our circles a little larger? If we want to serve citrus, let's get it from Arizona and not from Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we start to widen. You know, can we get our produce from states that touch Colorado? Could we start with that? You know, can we say that's our region? And I think if we all look to where we live and say, you know, how close can we get? We can't always be buying from the farmer next door. That's not reasonable. But it makes more sense to buy from a farmer in Arizona than a farmer in China or a farmer in Mexico.
Amen. So what about the money?
And you have to really, really, really look at the money. I mean, we have spent months now, literally months, 6 months, looking at our budgets, looking at our costs, reevaluating what we spend on what, how we can utilize the National School Lunch Program commodities. Are there brown box? This is raw commodities that we can use. How can we work with local producers to produce some of our product for us? And who wants to partner with a school district? So you have to really, really work at it and think about it and, you know, have a clear vision on your priorities. So as you start making change, it can be financially viable and sustainable.
How much more will it cost to feed good children good food rather than good children bad food?
You know, nationwide, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of advocates say a lot of different things. But at the very, very least, I advocate more than this, but at the very least, I believe the National School Lunch Program should add a dollar to the now $2.70 and to take it up to $3.70. But I think that dollar should really be dedicated to fresh fruits, vegetables, and whole grains procured regionally. And if you did that, you would have better food on the plate right away because it was fresh fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. But also you would be putting money back into the regional economies, into regional agriculture, so we would have a win-win.
So the money would keep going around in the community instead of flowing away to China.
Or wherever. That's right. And so I think, you know, one of the things that I hope that the government does when they look at child nutrition reauthorization, which will probably happen sometime in early 2010, is really think about raising the guidelines so chicken nuggets, tater tots, and chocolate milk, canned fruit cocktail cannot be a reimbursable meal, and also to really looking at giving schools another dollar, but taking that dollar and making it be for fresh fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, so we don't just take that dollar and make, you know, a really fancy chicken nugget out of it.
Okay, and when we get back, I'm going to ask the real big question to Ann Cooper, who is chef, author, and renegade lunch lady, which is, of course, how on earth do you get kids to eat good food? Do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We will be right back. Well, how on earth are you going to get good kids to eat good food instead of good food, good children eating bad food, which is what they're so prone to do given the nature of our food chain? When Dr. Stephen Schoenthaler went to study crime and nourishment, he worked with the wardens of prisons and the principals of schools, and the first thing he did was got rid of the vending machines. And then they did their double-blind studies, and as soon as Dr. Stephen Schoenthaler turned his back, the vending machines came back, and that's what people fed themselves from. Ann Cooper, how on earth are you going to teach good kids how to eat good food?
You know, one of the things that we found is really effective is hands-on experiential learning and cooking and gardening classes. When you get kids to own what they eat, it's much, much easier. So we see kids, urban kids, you know, rural kids, city kids, in gardens, pulling up carrots, pulling beans off of the plants, and they will try anything. It's really unbelievable. Picking up raw beets and baby beets and taking a bite. So I just think that this idea of hands-on experiential learning, both in cooking and gardening classes, really helps. And I often characterize this as the three-legged stool: delicious, nutritious food in the cafeterias, hands-on experiential learning in cooking and gardening classes, and academic curriculum to tie it all together. Mm-hmm. And some of the things we do are tastings in cafeterias. We have advisory councils of kids talking about what they'll eat and what they won't. And also, you know, a lot of positive peer pressure is great, where you get some kids who like the food to talk to other kids about it, and also getting parents and teachers involved, you know, letting them help kids, younger kids at the salad bars, or getting the teachers eating in the cafeteria. That totally helps.
You know, with respect to some of the processed food, the people who process those foods have really learned how to trick the taste buds, as it were, with fats and sugars and salts. Can good food compete with those taste bud ticklers?
Yeah, it absolutely can. It's harder to change bad habits, but we absolutely can. And I often say that if we're really going to fix the National School Lunch Program, if we're really going to fix school food, it's going to take a decade. Because you may not be able to fix the high school kids right now, although many of them will get it eventually. But if you start with the kindergartners and first graders, but by the time they get to high school, they've already been eating this food for 10 years. And so it's not going to be foreign, and it's not going to be weird. Does that mean they'll always make good choices? Absolutely not. None of us do. You know, I mean, I might like...
Are you going to admit to fast foods?
No, I'm going to admit to foie gras and champagne, and neither one. It's something that we ought to be eating every day. But if for me, you know, a treat is foie gras or champagne, you know, somebody else's treat might be, you know, McDonald's or M&M.
A Twinkie.
Yeah, and I think that those treats are okay. You know, there's everyday food and special occasion food. And no matter what the special occasion food is, you know, it should just be that special occasion.
You
and
know,
everyday food needs to be healthy food.
In thinking back to my youth and how my parents sent me to school always well-fed, I would never hungered for the sweets that the other children seemed to hunger for. They would always take their lunch money and run for the store and buy, a handful of penny candy, which actually you could get at those times for a penny, and certainly can't anymore. But I wonder if that's what you're talking about. You know, when you eat good food all the time, then the other junk food that seems to tempt us. You know, the soda pops, the candy, the processed foods don't seem to hold their sway over us as they would otherwise.
Well, I think, yeah, there's a lot of research has been done, and a lot of people have talked a lot about the fact that, you know, when you're filled, you know, when you're filled with good food, you don't hunger, you don't crave something else. And when we're taking in so many empty calories, you know, a soda can have 200 or 300 calories depending on the size, and there's no nutrient value at all. So you drink a soda and you want another, you know, or you eat a cookie.
You're still hungry.
You're never satiated. And I think that's one thing good food does. It satiates us in a way that these empty calories don't.
So in your notes, you say dedicate resources to a national marketing campaign to help change children's relationship to food so that healthy, delicious food becomes cool food. Well, how on earth are you going to do that?
That's
genuinely transformative stuff there. How are you going to do that?
Well, I think in the same way that the government got us to stop smoking. I mean, how transformative was that? I mean, we had a nation where almost everyone smoked cigarettes, and now we have a nation where a real minority do. And part of it was marketing. How did the government get us to wear seatbelts? We never used to wear seatbelts. Now you don't think about getting in a car without clicking it, you know? So I think...
By finding us, mostly. and by taxing us, you know, by increasing the cost to... And so on.
Well, and I think there's something to be said. I mean, people have been talking about a sugar tax. You know, the idea that, whether it's a sugar tax or a fat tax, that we take these foods of minimal and no nutrient value, these foods that we really shouldn't be eating, and taxing them and making them more expensive so they sort of become luxury items. And I think there's something to be said for that. But there's also, you know, there's a lot of other ways to do it with kids. I mean, whether it's, you know, the kids' Saturday shows have some healthy themes to them, or, you know,
it isn't the healthy food that sponsors those shows.
Well, that's absolutely right, which is why the government has to step in. I mean, we really need the government's help. If we're going to get kids to eat healthy food, the government has to play its role.
And the role is to encourage healthy eating.
That's all we need to do. We need to help our kids make lifelong wellness choices. And frankly, you know, when it gets said, as it often does, is we can't afford it. We're going to pay now or pay later. You know, we're spending between $147 and $200 billion a year on diet-related illness. So when it's not that we can't afford it. I mean, it's that we have not chosen to really make our kids' health a priority.
Okay, and we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll finish up with Rory, who always has good questions, and chef and author and renegade lunch lady Ann Cooper. Do stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Great shot, Bob. I think you're on.
I just followed your lead.
Hey, by the way, did you break ground on your new building?
No way. I'm holding off until I see what the future holds.
So you're seeing a fortune teller?
You know what I mean. Things look a little uncertain.
The only thing certain in business is if you're not growing, you're losing. Yeah, we just opened our fifth facility last week. If you're following my lead, you'll call General Steel. Their pre-engineered steel buildings could save you as much as half the cost compared to conventional buildings. And they're up in nearly half the time, and back with a 50-year structural warranty.
Yeah, but steel buildings...
Hey, you've seen my building. Does it look like steel?
No, it looks great.
Ask about rebates that could save you up to $20,000. Look, you can stop paying rent and own a building that suits your business better, and probably saves you money by operating more efficiently. In times like these, don't stop spending, just spend wisely.
Call 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290, 800-965-1290.
Well, what do you think? Can schools serve good food in hard times? We certainly have good food, and we certainly have hard times. Can we find some way to put them all together? What do you think, Rory? Well, Ann Cooper, can we?
Yes, we absolutely can. And I think that, you know, we... Really, I mean, I think it's our moral imperative to make these changes. I think we can, as a nation, figure out how to feed our kids better food. I mean, you know, we've been hearing lately about, just recently there was talk on NPR about, you know, having manned space flight to Mars. I mean, we can do so many things. We've got a Cash for Clunkers program that spent $4 billion over the last 90 days, and that's 50% as much as feeding our kids for an entire year. There's no reason why we can't fix this problem. We just have to make it a priority. a priority that our children's health is one of the most important things to all of our futures.
So in practical terms, where do we start?
I think everyone has to start in their own communities. I think one of the things that we all can do is, you know, every school district in America has had to have in place a wellness policy since 2006, but many of them were just kind of pushed through, and many of them are now residing on some administrator's desk or bookcase. And so we need, as parents and advocates, to go to school boards and say, what is your wellness policy? Then we need to go into schools and eat that food and see, you know, what the differences are, and then go back to the school boards and say, you know, this isn't good enough. We have to change it. And personally, one of the things I'm doing is my foundation, the Food Family Farming Foundation, has a new web portal. And it's called the Lunchbox, which is part of the Lunchbox Project. And this website, in collaboration with Whole Foods and some others, is going to be open as a beta test site on Monday. So we're trying to put a lot of the information that we use when we work with schools out there in the public domain, giving it all away so parents and advocates and administrators and nutrition services people can go and find the information they need to start making these, taking these baby steps and start making changes. And that website, thelunchbox.org. And so we're really trying to help people, advocates, parents, everybody, to help make changes for better school food.
Okay, Roy, do you have a question, a comment?
Yeah, a comment. I'm all for education, helping parents learn how to send their kids to school with a lunch. Like you're talking about a lunch box, I think it's got to be driven by the parents. And I'm definitely, you mentioned a sugar tax, bad idea. And I think you just got to get information out, educate people about, you know, bad sugars and all that. But we don't need another tax. We don't need another growth in bureaucracy. We got enough. I mean, we're battling back right now on carbon tax, et cetera.
Well, that's a fair question. If we want to expand school lunch to a universal program and do all of the things that we need to do, can we do it without creating a giant new federal bureaucracy? And because as we look at what we do have, two-thirds of our money goes into the bureaucracy and one-third goes into our children's bellies.
I absolutely think we can. I think, and I'm actually very optimistic about this. I'm really optimistic with the Obama administration and also the USDA sort of change of leadership with Vilsack and Merrigan. I'm really optimistic that these changes can be made without growing the existing infrastructure, without adding to the bureaucracy. I think we can start to make these changes by really just starting to put more money into better food.
Okay, thank you very much. Ann Cooper, author, chef, and renegade lunch lady, out to change the world by feeding our school children good food, which seems to me like a great idea. If we can get some good food into those good children, we'll have a good world to live in. Thank you so much for joining us, Ann, and thank you for tuning in out there. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.